I'd like to convene the Finance Committee. We don't have a quorum present yet. It may be the 20-degree below zero St. Paul temperature that's slowing some folks down. That's what it was at least earlier on the news. So we will change the agenda just a little bit. We'll wait on the Hilty bill until we do have a quorum present, and we'll begin with the overview where we left off at our last meeting. And the last few minutes, if you'll recall, we were just about to take up the higher ed bill and made a decision, being that there were only about 5 minutes remaining, that we'd wait until today. So Doug Bird is the fiscal analyst for higher education, and Doug, if you'd like to begin the overview.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the chairman said, I'm Doug Berg. I'm the fiscal analyst for the Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee, and I'll just run through a very brief overview. This will be much less in-depth than the K-12 one was, of the Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee's accounts. Members should have an item in their packets that's titled Overview of Higher Education Finance, and the first thing I saw was also passed out was a separate sheet. The second page is just a list of the committee's accounts, which I included because things have changed a little bit this year from the traditional Higher Education Committee. It has all of those accounts, the University of MSU, the Office of Higher Education, and the Mayo Foundation appropriations. But in addition, this year there are a variety of professional licensure boards for accountancy, barbering, architecture and engineering, the Department of Labor and Industry, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and a few miscellaneous accounts, Workers' Comp, Court of Appeals, Boxing Commission, a few things like that. So members can just look at that. A chart that members have seen before from Mr. Marks and Ms. Adrians and Mr. Kroll that we start with is the third page, and this is the allocation of state resources for the 2008-2009 committee, biennium by committee. It's the general fund base, and members will note then, we like to show this, that Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee comprises about 9% of general fund-based spending for the coming biennium. The fourth page is that same information in tabular format. You see that the base for this committee, general fund base again, is $2.91 billion for the 8-9 biennium before new appropriations. Moving on to the specifics for this committee, there is a large pie chart which is titled Higher Education Workforce Development Committee 8-9 General Fund Base. This shows the accounts within the committee by their share of the committee's general fund, and what I'd like members to note on this is that the general fund appropriations, the old higher education accounts, comprise 97% of the general fund appropriations that are in this committee. The U of M and MSU alone are more than 80% of the general fund dollars, and the Office of Higher Education, which is largely financial aid, is another 12%. In general fund dollars, all of those workforce development accounts are only about 4% of this committee's budget, a little less than that. Moving on to the non-general fund base, however, there's a slightly different picture. The next chart, which is a smaller pie, shows the all funds base for this committee. I would want members to note that the base jumps up to the all funds from the $2.9 billion to $6.4 billion when you count all funds. And if you see that there's a very different picture of which accounts are the biggest. The Department of Economic Employment and Economic Development becomes 20% of the budget because they have a large amount of non-general fund. MSU remains the largest account. We do actually draft. What I think members should know a little bit on this, and I know Mr. Marks talked about it in his presentation, is you need to think a little bit about what's in and what's not in when you talk about all funds. And for instance, the University of Minnesota drops in size on this graph, And it's not because they don't have other funds than general fund, but the University of Minnesota is a constitutionally independent entity, and most of their outside funding, federal funds and private funds, don't flow through the state treasury. So, for instance, when you look at that U of M piece, it's the same money that you looked at on the general fund pie. Their federal research dollars are not included. Their tuition dollars are not included. Things like all their private money is not included. Other items that you would not see in here are, for instance, the Office of Higher Education, Pell Grants, the main federal financial aid program. While that's a very integral part of how we figure financial aid at the state level, Pell Grants are grants from the U.S. Department of Education to individual students, and they don't flow through the state treasury. So then again, when you look at an all-funds base here, there's something on the order of $70 million a year in federal Pell funds that don't ever appear on an all-funds chart. So just like members to think about the fact when you see all funds that not everything is in there. It's everything we can capture in the state budget. And moving on, there's a bar graph that members will see that looks at the higher education portion of this committee's accounts as a share of general fund expenditures over a long period of time. There's been a lot of, the higher ed committee tends to look at this chart every year, and you'll see that over a long period of time, higher education funding has been a declining share of the state's general fund. Within the context of that time period, the general fund, of course, has gotten much bigger. But if you look at the growth in the general fund over the period of this graph, you'll find it's about 500% growth, whereas the growth in higher education appropriations is a little over 300%. So the general fund has been getting bigger, and so this share is a larger dollar figure, but it is smaller both in percentage terms and in relative inflation-adjusted terms over the course of that graph. In addition, then, the area chart that follows that looks at enrollment over a somewhat shorter period of time. And this is a little hard to read because it's so dark. The top area is MinSKU enrollment, and the bottom one is the University of Minnesota. But what members will note is that there has been a pretty substantial increase in enrollment over the course of the last 7 years. In total, about 35,000, almost 36,000 full-year equivalent students are new to higher education, mostly in the MinSKU system. That's about a 22.5% growth in the amount of students that are being served over this time period. And then since it always comes up, there's two graphs at the end of the packet which look at tuition for the University of MinSKU. They're not exactly analogous measures, but the way the systems look at them now, the first is the is MinSKU, and you'll see that the chart shows you of state appropriations for MinSKU and tuition being 100%, what percent is from tuition and what percent is from state appropriations, and you'll see that for fiscal year 06, there's about 52% appropriation and 48% tuition. Those figures have been coming together over a course of a number of years. And again, this is all state appropriations. The university looks at this, there's a federal measure that looks at direct instructional costs. And if you look at the last graph, you'll see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Berg, on your previous chart, do we still have in law the one-third, two-third support for higher education, where one-third would come from the student and two-thirds would come from the state? Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, there are two references in statute to the what you're talking about. The funding statute has a legislative intent section at the beginning, which says it is the intent of the state of Minnesota to fund two-thirds of the cost of college education, that one-third be from tuition. Later in that, as I say, that's just the intent section. The statute goes on to specify a funding formula, only part of which remains in statute. That portion says that the instructional appropriation will be two-thirds of the estimated cost of instruction. Now, as I think you are aware, over quite some period of time, if you look at everything that the system spend, if you look at the total amount of instructional costs, tuition has been more than 33% at both systems for quite a long time. On the other hand, I point out to members that the operative word in that statute is two-thirds of the estimated cost. And the higher ed bill has for many years had a statement in it that says this appropriation represents two-thirds of the estimated instructional cost. So it doesn't pay for two-thirds of the actual instructional cost. It pays for two-thirds of a number that the legislature puts in law every 2 years.
Mr. Chair.
That's simple.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Berg, using your chart, and I'll ignore for a second the definition of estimated cost, and I'll just go with your chart. What's the percentage of state support on your chart?
52%.
Which would be significantly less, Mr. Chair, Mr. Berg, than two-thirds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flaus, yes, although I go back to my statement earlier. The measure you see in front of you is not purely instructional cost. Minsky has... for purposes of coming over to legislature, not many members look at the issue of instructional costs versus non-instructional costs. So this number doesn't represent 52% of instructional costs. If you did that, you would still find that the state is not covering 66% of the
costs. Mr. Chair, Mr. Berg, I appreciate that. I also appreciate the fact that if I were a student and I were paying tuition, it would appear, particularly since about 2003, tuition has gone up almost every year, double digits, sometimes around 15%. I'm talking about primarily Minsky, but even at the U, it's been significant. And that we have had an incredible increase in debt, where we are now one of the leading states in student debt in the nation. So my next question is, can you tell me the impact, I'm going to first focus on the 2 years, of where we stand with tuition nationally in our two-year institutions? Looking at your chart, where are we if we rank the fifth states 1 to 50? Where are we with tuition as far as an expense?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pelosi, I can't tell you where we are ranked in the 50 states, but Minnesota has, at the two-year level, traditionally been a relatively high tuition state compared to other states. And I have not seen anything recently that other states have gone ahead of us. I can check what our actual ranking is,
Mr. Berg, I had students in my office last week, and they told me we were either second or third now in the nation for tuition in the country, which would tell me relatively high. I'd say that's very, very high tuition, and primarily as a result of what's happened the last 3 or 4 years. Mr. Berg, I've got a lot of questions, but I'm going to ask one more. Tell me the impact of the base cuts that were done to higher education at the University of Minnesota in the Minsky system in 2003 to balance the budget. Give me what happens when you do, first of all, the size of the base cut, and then the impact of the base cut.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, in the 2003 Omnibus Higher Education Bill, the base budget reduction for the two higher education systems was $380 million. Off the top of my head, I believe that amounted to about 14% of the systems, the two systems' general fund base. The total amount that the higher education budget went down was a little less than that because we did put some new money into financial aid that year, but the systems were cut $380 million. The impact of that is both systems had tuition increases that fall in I believe the university's was around 15% and Minsky's was, I think, on average around 12 or 13, and the next year again, tuition increases of that magnitude.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Berg, thank you. Mr. Chair, just an observation. This past summer, I had the opportunity to meet with the largest public universities in China, and we had a discussion of funding. And when it got around to how they fund their public institutions of higher education, I asked them, do you have a formula in place? And they said, oh, yes, yes, we do. We have a formula where the student pays one-third and the government pays two-thirds. And we think this is a very good formula. We understand your state has that formula, and we were emulating you. I just bring it up because we like to make comparisons sometimes from around the world. I would hope that we could at least tell the Chinese next time that we actually go by the formula we have as intent. I understand the intent, Mr. Berg. I understand the estimate, but I also understand the impact of these tuition increases and the debt. Thank you.
Representative Pulaski, did you happen to ask them then what their actual was?
Mr. Chair, I did. Their tuition, as far as compared to ours, is relatively low.
No, I meant, Representative Pulaski, you had a discussion earlier that we still have the one-third, two-thirds in statute.
Yes.
With the word estimated, and the actual is quite a bit different.
Mr. Chair, we had that discussion, too. It was a fascinating discussion. They are moving rapidly in the field of higher education. And they think they're copying us.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chairman, members, there's just one final chart that I was going to show, which is the tuition as a percent of instruction costs at the university. As I said, this is a little different measure. This is tuition as a percent of direct instructional costs, which takes some of the money out that are for indirect non-direct costs, gives you a somewhat higher figure, but also at the University of Minnesota, they have, Minsky tends to be more direct instruction. The university has other items, the university specials and research infrastructure that are not direct instruction. So it gives you a higher number as a general calculation, but you'll see that the university is now up to about 80% of direct instructional costs covered by tuition. And, Mr. Chairman, that's all the information I was going to present. I'd be happy to answer.
Okay, we have two additional members at this point that have indicated questions. I guess actually three. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We were just recently, in my last 2 minutes, talking about the worldwide comparison of tuition costs. Having been to Mexico several times, they informed me that there's no cost for tuition from first starting through college. There's no cost for health care, free health care all along the way. But they don't have any welfare. No welfare. So that seems to me that's a heck of a trade-off. There's a lot of money if you don't do any welfare for education. And health care if you don't do any welfare. So, I mean, you got to make some choices here. China may be doing one thing, we're doing one thing. Mexico is doing another.
Well, Madam Chair, to that point.
Yes.
To that point, Madam Chair, maybe Representative Huntley can correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Earhart, but I think over 80% of that cost is for people in nursing homes, so unless you want to dig a ditch and bury them, I think, you know, you're making an incorrect assumption for our expenditures for welfare, as you call it, because 75% of the people in nursing homes are on welfare, if that's what you want to call it. And I know that, having just taken care of an aunt for 11 years. So.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Cornish.
I've been to Mexico, Japan, Nicaragua, and different places on these tours and admired all sorts of civilizations, but I sure as hell wouldn't want to live in any of them. And we can admire the heck out of these different countries, but when it comes to living, and we're living in the U.S., I think everybody in every one of my tours has kissed the ground when they got back to the United States, so be careful of our comparisons. We could compare it with my missions in Nicaragua. They don't have schools, and a lot of places live on dirt floors. I mean, we've got all sorts of standards we can compare to. My kids just finished college, and about 4 years ago, and one of them had $20,000 in debt. She had two jobs, and my son finished with about $15,000 in debt. He had a couple jobs. he didn't do much complaining. He was glad to get an education. It'd be great if we can put some more money into the system, but let's look at the positive, too.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Representative Severson had a question.
Yes, Madam Chair. And I wonder if the testifier has two questions, please. Number one, number of dollars in 2003-2004 session that we put into scholarships and grants for educational institutions, and I say that because I know that we were looking at a $4.5 billion budget shortfall, infusing dollars into the higher ed institution or giving it to the students so that they could vote with their feet as to which institution they wanted to go to. And I wonder if you have those numbers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Severson, I don't think I have the 2004-05 state grant appropriation at hand. We did, I do remember, increase the amount of grant aid by about $35 million that year. As part of that, I mentioned, while we cut the system basis by $380 million, the total base cut for the committee was only about $350 million because we did some administrative cuts at the financial aid agency and then also put about $35 million in new money into the grant program. I can get you those numbers. There would have been about $130 or $40 million a year in state grants at that time. I'll get you the exact number later.
Thank you. Madam Chair, one follow-up question on this.
Representative Severson.
To Representative Pawlowski, I'm wondering in terms of China, and I knocked on the door of one of my constituents who is St. Cloud State University professor for physics, and he gave me some startling numbers. He said that, you know, that in Beijing they have a university of about 100,000, and about 80 to 90% of those are engineers. And we are in a deficit in terms of how our higher education institutions are targeting our younger group towards the business that is going to bring about new business in this country. And I guess my question on this one to Representative Pawlowski is, in terms of the U.S., or in terms of China, basically, is there a competitive system, or does everyone have access to those slots in the universities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Severson, as I understood it, everyone did, and that they were not only an extremely competitive system, but they were a system that enjoyed sending their students to the United States. I'm not saying their system is as good as ours. It is not. But I don't know what it will be like 10 years from now. We are still the premier educator in higher education in the world, and people come here for almost every degree you can imagine. A degree from the United States is a cherished thing and is an economic asset wherever you go. I just thought it was interesting in the discussion of their formula, that their formula was emulating this state's formula. And in fact, if you recall, when Japan was looking for a companion university at Akita, it came to Minnesota. And for a period of time, that Akita campus was part of the Minsky system. So they looked at us as the shining light in higher education.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, can I have one question on the grant program, please?
Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Berg, at any time in 03 or 04, did we shut down the grant program as a result of running out of funds?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, yes, in the 2002-2003 academic year, in, I believe, January of 2003, the grant program had to be suspended because there was not enough funding to continue giving grants. That actually was in the 2003 fiscal year, so it was prior to that year's bill with additional cuts being made. But, yes, the grant program ran out of funding in the middle of the academic year.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Berg, in the history of that program, had it ever been shut down before?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, no. There had always been enough funds to cover all the need in the program, and in one or two occasions I can remember where it was short at the end of a fiscal year, there was an emergency appropriation from the legislature to cover the difference.
Thank you.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Berg, the Mayo Clinic Foundation is the accounts that are in this committee, is that just the tuition subsidy for med school students that are in the Mayo?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, that is what that item is. That's not all that's in there. There are three different items in the committee's purview that deal with Mayo. The one you're looking at is subsidization of tuition for slots in the medical school and stipends for family practice residency slots. That program's been in place for many, many years. There is base funding at the University of Minnesota for expansion of their programs in Rochester. And in the governor's budget, there is $38 million for the Mayo University Biogenomics Partnership, which the governor appropriates to the university. Prior to that, it's been appropriated through the Department of Employment and Economic Development, both of which are in this committee at this point.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Berg, the medical education research money is not in this. Mark?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, that's correct. That is not appropriate. That money is not appropriated through the higher education budget.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just to respond to Representative Earhart and Representative Rukavina, the welfare part of the state budget, if you looking simply at cash subsidies to those, what we think about welfare, it's about 1% of the state budget. And the big bulk of that 30% in Health and Human Services is either people in nursing homes or people with disabilities. And if you want to look at the historical trends, in the mid-80s, we spent about the same amount of money on higher ed as we spent on Health and Human Services. Today we're spending three times as much on Health and Human Services as we're spending on higher ed.
Do we have a quorum present? We have had for a few moments. So, Representative Mahoney. And
I've looked at these minutes, and I think they're all just absolutely correct, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move them.
Representative Mahoney moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. You didn't have any additional questions then?
I did. I have a question for Representative Pawlowski. My hearing's going bad, and I probably need some medical help, but I'm not sure whether you were, when you talked about China looking to Minnesota or look. Is it current tense or past tense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Honey, both.
Thank you.
Okay, aren't any other questions, so we'll do, I asked the division chairs to make a few comments about some of the issues that they saw coming forward, so we'll hear from the division chair and then the finance division chair for the overall of the three divisions. So Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, your staff asked me to talk about the top two or three priorities of my division, and I'd have to say in order of importance, they're tuition, and tuition. We've spent about five hearings bringing in students from all across the state of Minnesota in all the different systems, including the private, non-profit, and for-profit colleges. And I think it's fair to say that for those sitting here on this committee that have heard their stories, it's kind of frightening what's going on out there. Representative Cornish, there's people graduating from technical colleges with $20,000 in debt and from graduate programs at the university that were upwards of $80,000, $90,000. And I've had one email with $180,000 in debt. So when we look at the governor's proposal, even though there is a bunch of new money there, a lot of it's one time. Both systems, MinSCU had a 4% increase, I believe, built into their request, and university about a 4.5%. And when you back out the one-time money and what the governor has put in, I'm afraid that if the systems, at least the university, can make up its shortfall, that we'd be approaching 9 or 10% again in tuition increases. So, it's going to be a tough approach to some of the promises and discussions that we had during the last election. I heard the governor talking about giving free tuition, I believe it was, to people in the top 25% of their class, which now he's backed off on that, and he's got his Achieve 2 program geared more towards, which doesn't, I don't think, help the current folks in college. And so I'm really, really nervous about what's going to happen, because there was a big discussion, as I said, about tuition. We were hoping to maybe look at holding tuition for once to zero and zero, Mr. Chair, which I think would cost about $150 million more than the two systems requested. So, you know, we do have other things to look at also in the other divisions or the other agencies within this new division, the workforce training and those issues, and maybe we can blend some of those programs and use some of that money more wisely to help, you know, to help try to solve at least this problem a little bit. But, you know, I was thinking about it the other day when I was looking at the budget request, and, you know, the two systems requested not only an inflationary increase to pay their staff and for inflationary costs, but also then built that 4% increase in Minsky and 4.5% at the university. And I thought, you know, when other agencies not only ask for their inflationary increase, but then build automatically an increase into their systems that's basically above inflation. So I hope, Mr. Chair, that whoever's going to make decisions around here on targets would think about what we're doing to our students in this state. And Representative Pawlowski, it's nice to see the Chinese communists are, modeling themselves after the state of Minnesota. I suspect that a lot of people at this table are helping to pay for their tuition over there. Myself, I don't buy anything made in China, Mr. Chair, so I'm not helping that cause. I'm running out of clothes. I'm running out of underwear. It's going to be tough. But I refuse to spend any money. So, you know, that's a whole other problem. But with that, I'll end. If anybody's got any questions
maybe
about anything except my underwear, and I'm happy to answer.
Maybe you can find a good tailor on the range. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My committee is the overarching committee that will look at the priorities of the three divisions or four divisions that we're working cooperatively with, and try to talk about the things that go beyond one division and promote lifelong learning. And our goals are especially to look at how library services are being delivered and costs, community education, and adult basic education. Those are the three big things that seem to jump out at having to do with each of the divisions, and we want to see where they're going this year.
Thank you. Representative Thun had a question.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if this is for Representative Murphy or for Representative Rugovino, but as you know, the University of Minnesota is in my district, and so I follow things pretty carefully. And I keep looking at the statement that President Grunix makes, that his major goal for the last place I saw it was, I see it lots of places, last place was in the program for the one of the women's basketball games, but his statement that his major goal is to have the University of Minnesota be one of the top three public universities in the world. My first question, and I, since I didn't attend those meetings, that I wish you'd ask him when he comes, is which is he going to displace? University of Michigan, University of California, Oxford, Cambridge, or the Sorbonne? And the next question is, every time some plan of what the university is doing comes out, I would like the question to be asked, does this advance us in the goal of becoming one of the three top research universities in the world? You know, like football and basketball buyouts and those sorts of things.
Okay. I assume that was, rhetorical.
Right,
okay, Representative Earhart, and then we'll move to the bill that's before.
Mr. Chairman, I do, Representative Kahn, that time she said it right. Research in the
yes,
she didn't, but you didn't say that the first time, so I just wanted to make sure that that's
okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Berg. And we'll now go, for those of you that arrived late, I assume it was due to the cold weather, but we did move down to item number 5 on the agenda, or at least part of it, which was Mr. Berg's presentation. We'll be reverting back now to House File 160 by Representative Hilty. And I would like to make a comment before I call on Representative Kahn to move adoption of the committee engrossment. But it's my intent procedurally to rely on the divisions to have done the basic work on the bills and to have taken the testimony and that kind of thing. What I have asked, and this is a good example, is that the Secretary of State's office be available. This is a bill that they're interested in for questions. And if any member has a question of, in this case, the Secretary of State's office or in the future others, that's the way we'll try to operate, and that way we've respected the work of those divisions. So, Representative Kahn, would you care to move adoption of the committee engrossment?
Yes, I move adoption of the committee engrossment.
That motion is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that House File 160 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Hilty, if you'd like to go over the bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 160, as you can see, is basically a one-sentence bill. That sentence being from lines 211 to 215. And what it does is allow, after appropriate notification to every conceivable concerned party, I guess, the Secretary of State's office to use HABA funds, the Help America Vote Act federal funds that are dedicated for HABA purposes from some of the purposes that were specified when the funds were initially allocated to other purposes within that list of approved purposes. The reason for that is that there was a great deal of uncertainty back when these funds were initially allocated about what would be needed. And so rather than just appropriate them in a lump, what was done, and this was largely to satisfy concerns of local elections officials across the state, what was done was that there were a number of categories specified and an allocation of funds to each of those. As it turns out, some of the funds were not needed at all, that being the case with the complaint processing category. In other categories that are specified in the bill, some of the funds were used, but at this point, it's not really necessary or even possible at this point in time to continue expending them for those purposes. And what has occurred is that all the funds that were appropriated for the continued development of the state voter statewide voter registration system have been expended, and I think that there's a pretty general agreement between the Secretary of State and local elections officials that that's what needs to be the focus of effort and expenditures at this point. So that's what this bill would allow. It doesn't involve any state funds. There are federal funds that were dedicated for those purposes, and all the bill is doing is moving them from one specified purpose to another. We did in government operations have testimony from a representative of local election officials testifying in support of the bill, and of course it's supported by the Secretary of State.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, questions, and as I mentioned, in fact, for the record to show, Mr. Black is present from the Secretary of State's office if anyone would have questions of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've dealt with a bill similar to this in the past, Representative Hilty, Mr. Black. A couple questions. One is I had someone from the Iron Range lobbying me last week about the fact that we still mandate, as of next year, townships having to use these voting machines for township elections. In other words, the March elections we have out in the rural townships, they have to drag this machine in. This is not mandated by federal law that they have to do this for townships, only for state and federal offices, primaries and generals, which I think is not a bad thing. But when you have seven people showing up for an election and it costs you $400 to $500 to program a machine, and nobody in the room is blind or deaf, I'm wondering what are we doing with that? We've kicked this around now for 3 or 4 years. We've came very close to a compromise, Representative Hilty. And any time we pass these types of things and we don't pay for them, it's an unfunded mandate, which I'm not real big on. And I see on the last page it says, notwithstanding Minnesota Statute 16A, which is when we appropriate money as a legislature, all the Secretary of State has to do now is give in writing a letter to the chair and ranking minority member of the committees which have jurisdiction over the budget of the Secretary of State. I would guess that would be Representative Kahn and Senator Betzold. The Secretary of State can now transfer any unencumbered balance from various appropriations up to the front, the top three. And I know when Secretary Kiffmeyer was in charge of the office, we never would have considered giving her this type of authority as far as I remember. Where did this language come from? And why wouldn't we say that this, if we're going to keep the mandate in place, why wouldn't we take all that money and pay the townships for the mandate that we're forcing them to do?
Okay. Well, Chair, Representative Seifert, we did have this discussion with Representative Swigum in State Government Finance regarding the township. I think you're aware that I spent quite a lot of effort and legwork in trying to work out a compromise bill at the end of last session. That did include initially the proposal to extend for another election cycle that exemption for local elections. The reason that didn't get included in the compromise is that the author of the bill to extend it indefinitely refused to accept that compromise, so it didn't happen. At the time, I told the concerned township officials that there would conceivably be time to act on that at the beginning of this session, and I promised them that I would attempt to deal with it, whatever issue remained at that point. One of the first things I did when session began is ask for Mr. Sulem from the who's representing the Township Association to come and talk to me about this, and what he told me was that the association had decided at this time not to pursue anything. I said I thought that there was time to do that. He said that that their feeling at the moment was that there was a great deal of uncertainty about the cost, that there was a range in cost in dealing with this from roughly $80 to $800, and I wanted to see how that actually turned out, and I believe that also the experience they had with the equipment in the general election was a lot less dramatic than they had expected. So that's where it stands right now, Representative Seifert. I have attempted to deal with the township officials, and nothing more has happened because they told me they didn't want to pursue anything more, or at least that's what Mr. Sulem told me, representing the Township Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty, regardless of what Mr. Sulem has said, I have heard from township officials from the southwest to the northeast that they are still concerned about this as an unfunded mandate when you have 7, 9, 11 people showing up for township elections, and that this simply is going to be a property tax increase. And I'm wondering why we wouldn't take the unexpended appropriations and divide them out to townships for the purpose. If we're going to pursue the mandate, why we wouldn't, instead of just handing it over to the Secretary of State, just say we acknowledge that this is going to be a mandate and we're going to give the township some money to pay for the programming costs. Because all of mine in my area have said it's going to be in the hundreds of dollars of expenditure. And then to me that would make sense if that's what the federal government is mandating on us. At least we can be somewhat reasonable for the rural people not to raise their property taxes to pay for something that, and I would guess 90%+ of the cases is not a necessary exercise in forcing machine down their throat. Would that be something that we'd be open to, Mr. Black, on the Secretary of State side?
Mr. Black?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Seifert, I am Bert Black, a legal advisor with the Office of the Secretary of State. The office is interested in working both with the townships and with members of the disability community who are also concerned about the accessibility, both physical and machine accessibility, at the polling places. As I said, we're willing to talk to everybody. I would simply point out that this money is before you this early in the session because this is this year's appropriation through June. The elections at the local level this year are not subject to the voting machine requirement this year. There was some legislation that was passed last year that allowed the local units of government to access the part of the voting machine contract that was done at the state level in the cooperative purchasing unit of the Department of Administration for the programming costs. And if you gang up these programming jobs, Representative Hilty is correct, it's estimated to be under $100 per township. But that is starting next year, and this money is simply through June 30th. And frankly, the county auditors just recently passed a resolution. This is their priority in terms of getting the voter registration system to be more robust than it already is. This is a system which basically takes a lot of hits and a lot of usage in a very short period of time, and their complaint has been that this is a very, it tends to slow at those peak times. So that's really what we're doing here, is we're asking for the flexibility to move the money to something which we need to work on this year, because it takes a long time to program these items. There will be, Mr. Chair and Representative Seifert, in the regular budget request, there will be, there is more federal money, which this legislature needs to appropriate before anybody has access to it. And I suspect that this question will come up again during that discussion. And that will be money for the period during which this would then be, this voting machine requirement would be in effect.
That's your last question. Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Black, you look at the amount of money and you wonder if it's enough or not, $1.218 million in sub 1. When I chaired the committee, I can tell you, and Representative Hilty would know because he was the ranking member at the time, there are plenty of lobbyists and special interests representing voting machine companies that are very interested in this money. And, of course, they're only in it for the sake of good democracy, not because there's more money to be made off of forcing townships to have voting machines when they only have 7 people and none of them are blind. It's only for good democracy's sake. It's not because there's money to be made for the voting machine companies, I'm sure. That's a little sarcastic comment for them that were circling outside my office on a regular basis. But I would say that there is a voting machine task force that we set up. Representative Hilty and I did at least come to an agreement that we should have a task force that is supposed to report to this legislature by February 15th, which is coming up here in 10 days. And I'm sure that Representative Pawlowski's committee is going to be having a hearing on the results of that task force and trying to implement whatever it is that they came up with. But I would just say that let's not just look at dumping money into a system that maybe isn't even necessary in a lot of these cases, but rather look at some common sense, that if you have someone in the township that requests a machine that it automatically is used, that's a compromise I offered, and it was rejected from the advocates. If you don't need the machine, I'm trying to figure out why we are going to require, this is for township elections in March, not for president and for state representative and county commissioner and all those types of things. Why we wouldn't be able to come up with a common sense solution for this. So I'm anxious to look at this. I don't have any amendments today, but I certainly think if there's leftover money in these accounts, we're making the appropriations right now, it makes sense to set this aside for mandate relief if we don't come up with a good report here in 10 days. Thank you.
Representative Rocavino. Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, first of all, I really want to commend you for as vigilant as you were to make sure that Minnesota at least wasn't one of those states that didn't have a record of how people voted and that we did have a paper trail. You did a really great job on that, but I have heard also from townships, and I have to say that Representative Seifert is bringing up, Representative Sertich and I were at a meeting after our township association in St. Louis County after the elections, and our county auditor was there, and many of the townships did bring up some concerns on this. So I'm hoping, you know, as Representative Seifert said, the township elections are coming up in March, and maybe even though the lobbyists for the townships didn't bring a concern to you, I know that many of the township officers that night and up in Cotton, Minnesota, did bring a concern to us. So maybe we can try to work on it before. But I see this money is for totally a different purpose, and I have no problem with that. But I hope we could do that, Representative Nielsen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rucavina, I made that commitment to the townships that I would continue to work with them in any way that we could. I would point out that while there certainly is that concern, and I have certainly heard it from township officers, that's not universally the case. In fact, I have had some township officers tell me that while they thought this was a really stupid idea to require them to do that in the first place, one of the things that they discovered is that although they thought they didn't have anyone in the community that would want to or need to use that equipment, it turned out that they did. There is a very clearly defined other side to this question, which is why it's been so difficult to resolve. But as I said, I'm committed to continuing to work with everybody involved to find some reasonable solution.
Representative Figger.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Black, if I could, or Mr. Hilty, not to belabor the point, because I think the flexibility in the bill we're talking about here is a reasonable flexibility, but to carry on with the discussion of Representative Rucavina and Representative Seifert, point blank, we have the exemption for townships. I think both representatives spoke well to the issue. We have the exemption until 2008, is that correct? Sir, will you and the Secretary of State's office support a permanent exemption for our townships or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Swigum, I am not authorized to, and don't know the position, in fact, of the office on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mr. Black or Representative Hilty, I respect the negotiations that you're in. Compromise always seems to be what you want, maybe rather than what somebody else wants. I think Mr. Solem, when I spoke to him, he said they might not be seeking it from a township association, quote, because of the political realities of big government that has been changed here recently, or something to that effect. I might not have quoted it directly, but close enough to, for government work anyway. Mr. Hilty, will you support, as author of this bill, and I assume maybe the next one, with Mr. Rukavina, Mr. Seifert, and I, and a whole host of others around here, an exemption for our townships on a permanent basis? Just a yes or no is all I need, Mr. Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swigum, that's not a yes or no
okay,
situation.
I don't need any more than that.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, my question has been answered.
We have then the motion before us that House File, by Representative Hilty, that House File 160 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
And carried. The materials, just by way of announcement, we had requested when K-12 finance was before us are included in your packets, just so everybody was aware of that. We're now going to go down to item number 6 on the agenda, presentation by the Finance Department regarding the report on expenditure increases. That's Jim Showalter and Brent Gustafson.
Mr. Chairman, while they're coming forward, can I make an announcement?
Absolutely.
For many people on this committee are also on Ways and Means Committee. You probably heard on the radio this morning that Pilot Knob school system is canceled today. That's where we're going to hold a hearing because of a broken water main. And we've just been informed that the broken water main is fixed. The kids get the day off, but we don't this evening. Okay. So thank you.
So the meeting is still on.
The meeting is on. The water main is fixed.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Showalter for the record. I'm the State Budget Director with the Department of Finance. Appreciate the invitation to come here and speak with you today. The report is actually the first submission, the first final submission of the fastest growing expenditures, a report that was required and mandated by the legislature 2 years ago. We also submitted a similar report last year and set up a trial run. The purpose of the report is to help legislators and the public understand what's going on in the state budget. At least that's our interpretation of it, that certainly the forecast can be a rather large document, can be a rather dense document, explaining a lot of things that are going on with public spending as well as revenue. In this document, what we try to do is take a look at what are some of the key issues, what are some of the key programmatic areas that are changing biennium to biennium, and try to give you a little bit more explanation of what's going on there. We've emailed copies of this document over to the legislature. You have copies in your packets today. And this slide that I have in front of you right now is something that's probably somewhat familiar. The slide that we used in the presentation of the governor's budget recommendations, it summarizes information that you would have seen in the November forecast as well. This report really does focus on the November forecast. And when you look at the November forecast, you see there's a number of changes. Our discussion tended to be fairly high level. There's some changes in K-12, there's some changes in higher education, a lot of changes in health and human services, so on and so forth. When you get to this document, this really helps to explain on a programmatic basis what's going on an individual basis. So, for instance, if you look at the programs that are listed here, you have information on medical assistance for basic care for families and children, for elderly and disabled, Minnesota care, long-term care waivers, so on and so forth, as well as changes in education and other area parts of the budget. As the report itself explains, over $1 billion, actually $1.3 billion of growth from 06-07 to 08-09. If you remember from the forecast, overall state spending grew by $1 billion. So if you're confused about what's going on in the state budget, if you're confused about why spending is going up, if you look at this report, you've got a pretty good one-stop shop for 10 programs or so that it can explain virtually all of the overall growth. Lots of smaller changes here and there, but this report will give you most of the changes. We now have this graph. This graph is just context. This is a graph that is not in the report itself. It's just the overall forecast change. So I will, if that's a problem.
Okay, that clarified that. I was looking for it myself in the report here, and so you did, Representative Solberg.
So, Mr. Showalter, on page one of your document, the 3.2% in the last graph there is the same bottom number as the graph you had up on the screen? I'm looking on page one of your document. The very last graph is 3.2%. Is that the same 3.2% that you had up on the screen?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it is.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Clark?
Mr. Chair, I was just trying to understand if that $1 billion increase, does that take into consideration the inflationary increases, or what you're saying that that's already being, it's already programmed in based on the growth of population, on the need growth, does it also in any way consider inflation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I know it does not, and I think that's part of what helps in this report is to help you understand what elements there are, some inflationary costs that are associated with some of these health care programs, and helps you understand a little bit about how much of the growth is related to enrollment, growth in average costs, things like that. In terms of the global budget, the discretionary inflation issue, that is not associated with the numbers that are shown in the forecast. That's added after that off you know, sort of below the bottom line. And that's not included in the number that you're shown here.
Representative Clark, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Schumann, I guess the governor knew about this ahead of time, too, when he was predicting the surplus fund.
Mr. Chair, Representative, these numbers are part of, what this report provides you is a greater explanation of the programs that were explained and part of the November forecast. So it basically says, okay, of all the numbers, we sent over lots of spreadsheets, lots of information, an explanation of what was going on, some at a very summary level, some at a fairly detailed level. This requirement and what this report seemed to ask finance was for a more narrative explanation of what are some of the things that are behind this. Could you tell us a little bit more of the story about why some of these programs are changing and give us an explanation. So, yes, this information was part of the numbers that was included in the November forecast, was part of the bottom line, $2.2 billion that's available for spending this biennium, and it's an explanation of why it isn't 3.2, that some of those expenditures have already grown and are included in those numbers.
Thank you.
And just so everybody's clear, and you've probably noticed on the first page there, this report then was required under the law, and that's why we're hearing it here today. Representative Kahn?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Showalter, just relating back to the discussion that we just had about higher education, one of the important parts of higher education is the salaries paid to the instructional faculty. And I would guess that in putting your report together, you're looking at income taxes paid for people throughout the state?
Mr. Chairman, we're not looking at the revenue side, so we're only looking at the expenditure side. That addresses. So we're not looking at income taxes necessarily.
Okay.
Representative Kahn.
I don't know. Okay. So we're just looking at expenditures in this. But in the budget forecast, in the forecast, the complete forecast, you are looking at revenue and expenditures.
Ms. Schollander, Representative. Yes, we are.
So I assume on the revenue side, when you're looking at the income received by these instructional people in higher education, that you assume that they've gotten no inflationary increase?
Mr. Showalter?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would defer to Dr. Stinson on that question. My assumption is he would say it's included, that in the great scheme of the economy, one segment of college faculty's raise is a relatively minor number compared to the overall trend, which would be forecast in his revenue projection.
It's just puzzle to me is, you know, I admit it's a small part of the numbers, but my background makes me look at small parts of things. But so you're including in the revenue that comes in an inflationary increase in the salaries of certain people, but then in the expenditures going out, your prediction is that they're not, your forecast is based on them not getting those increases.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our forecast is based on current law, which says that we should not include inflation within the expenditure numbers. So what we do is we basically have two concepts. One is, for those of you less familiar with the forecast, is that we have something known as the base, which is essentially taking the last act by the legislature, 2007 appropriations in this instance, and carrying that forward. So if the legislature says that $500 million should go to X institution, we would show that in 2007, and then, say, in 8 and 9, our guess, our forecast is $500 million, continues to go forward, with further action from the legislature required, of course, for spending that money. In some instances, however, the legislature has set up programs that are basically defined, so that any comers can come in and get services and are essentially entitled to those services, and that spending is more or less programmed in. Examples of that would be medical assistance. That's probably the easiest one. K-12 education would be another easy one to sort of conceptually understand, where a student coming to a public school is entitled to services. We pay schools on a per-student basis, and so as a result, if there are increases or decreases projected in our school world, our school population, we include that in the forecast for state expenditures. Similarly, if we anticipate changes due to demographics, due to caseload, acuity, other economic things, we include forecast changes in the forecast. So those are the two basic concepts and elements that are folded into our expenditure forecast. Within this report, most of what you see is associated with that latter group, forecast changes, elements that are due to some economic, programmatic change that are beyond the direct control of the legislature. There are, however, other programs or other things that are changed just because, well, the program was expanded or that the program nature was changed. And so you also see biennial growth there as well.
Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn had alluded to the point that whatever state workers were getting from one year to the other, what was the pay increase for state workers July 103 to July 104? If I remember right, it was zero.
Mr. Chair, I believe that is correct. I would need to double check, but I believe that's correct.
So, Mr. Chair, instead of automatically assuming government should grow on autopilot, wouldn't it make more sense that we go to a concept of zero-based budgeting where we don't assume that we're going to have automatic growth in anything, and that if we have an entitlement program where someone shows up, they're going to get served, but everything else would be considered discretionary? And, of course, it's put in on the revenue side because they have to certify the numbers that are coming in. People's paychecks are growing, and that's a reality, and people are spending more at the Mall of America, and we're collecting more sales tax revenue, et cetera. But to assume that the legislature is going to be giving X percent is really a false notion, because the legislature might give 0% of a raise and might give 5% of a raise, depending on what the budget situation. That's the discretionary spending that this legislature makes. And, of course, I know there are people in the room who want government to go automatically, because then if anyone questions it, it's considered a cut. So if you were going to go up 3% and you go up only 1%, suddenly the special interest groups are yelling that they're getting cut 2% when, in fact, they're getting an actual increase.
I think rather than heavily debating that issue at this point in time, let's let Mr. Showalter continue with the report.
Mr. Chair, members, the report it basically takes a look at, as I mentioned, the growth in expenditures. We use a cutoff of 15%, biennium to biennium. So essentially, if a program was growing, say, roughly 7 to 8% each year, it would meet the trigger necessary to be reported more fully in this report. Most of the programs that are listed here are in the general fund. There are some non-general fund items as well. And so you understand 15% growth is something that we looked at last year and looking at this year. And it just gives you it's a somewhat relative trigger to help you understand that something's growing significantly faster than most programs in general. For the last decade, the budget grew about 8.7% per biennium, so it's, you know, not quite double, but significantly higher than on average. As I mentioned earlier, factors contributing to that growth varies by program, but it includes programmatic trends like enrollment changes, things like that. And they include budget choices, such as debt service, where increased bonding authorizations lead to increased debt service in future years. And it also includes technical and accounting issues, sometimes where something might be either a one-time basis, 1 year, or annualized going into the future. The programs listed in the report, and I will just touch on them. We have executive budget officers here who wrote up the analysis and can certainly comment to greater detail if you would like to look at each of these or any of these. But they include medical assistance, basic care for families and children, where we see significant enrollment growth, as well as some cost increases. Same issues for medical assistance for elderly care and disabled persons. Minnesota Care, where actually some of the enrollment is decreasing, but there are significant cost increases going on there as well. Long-term care waivers, part of the medical assistance program, where almost all the components are serving different elements of the population, but almost all of those are still growing at over 15% rate. Group residential housing, growing more quickly than per-person costs, and enrollment is more of a factor there. It's sex offenders, treatment for persons who are civilly committed continues to grow on a biennium to biennium basis. Other programs include desegregation transportation aid within our education budget, charter school lease aid, homeowners property tax refund, enrollment and enlistment incentives, and debt service transfer. Each of those is itemized, and then there is a table at the back that provides some additional programs that are more technical in nature as to why they grew 15%. In my summary comment is that we've tried to provide a unit of analysis that's useful. We hopefully meet that mark for this committee and the financing divisions as well. But you should know that's a difficult choice. For instance, drug costs is something that everyone knows is rising rapidly. There's no program necessarily to say this is the state drug cost program. It's an element of cost that goes into services for elderly and disabled, families and children, et cetera, et cetera. We've tried to use the appropriations and the types of programs that we recognize in our budgeting process and our discussion as being the unit of analysis for the growth. There are certainly factors behind those that also merit discussion either here or in committee.
Okay, we have some questions. Representative Solberg, Kahn, and then Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, very quickly, Stormwater. On page 4 of your handout in the human services, it gives a description of why that happens. And I'm curious on the health match, why there's a shift from Minnesota Care to the general fund medical assistance. It says when health match is implemented, and it says this growth is it seems to be due to that particular shift. Can you tell me what, I'm not real smart, what health match is and why and who implemented it?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I certainly can. I'm going to ask Lisa Miller to come on down and join me on this one. Health match is a system of, eligibility determination that has been in the works at the Department of Human Services for a number of years.
Representative Cornish. You wanted to make that announcement. I thought we were going to do it at the end, but
well, I can wait till next meeting.
No problem?
Yeah.
Okay. Excuse me. Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, Lisa Miller from the Department of Finance. Representative, Health Match is an automated eligibility determination system that's being developed by the Department of Human Services. And when Health Match is fully implemented, it's going to shift a number of enrollees from Minnesota Care, which is funded out of the Healthcare Access Fund, into medical assistance, basic care for families and children, which is funded out of the general fund. And that's why you see a cost increase in the MA Families and Children's Program because of the shift from Healthcare Access Fund costs to general fund costs.
So, Mr. Chairman, just very quickly, as I look down further in the paragraph, that you got 8.1% cost per enrollee. So is that what we should be looking at, is the true cost and the growth is 8.1 instead of the 22.7? Because you're shifting it from one fund to another, and it looks like there's a big growth in it, but there's a must be a corresponding decrease in the other fund. And then when I look at the what's verbiage is, it seems that that much of that is due to medical inflation. So it looks like the 8.1% is the true number that we should be looking at, and that's due to medical inflation. Is that a correct assumption to be drawn from that particular page?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. There are a couple things happening in this program, one of them being health match, and so, and another of them being an average cost increase. So of the 22%, about 8.1% is due to increasing average cost.
Average cost, Mr. Chair, of medical, the medical costs of paid to the doctors and hospitals, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I may add, the comparison points are annual and biennial figures as well. The 22.7% figure at the top is a biennium to biennium comparison. The 8% figure is an annual growth. So even on simple math, that would be more like a 16% biennial comparison. So the rest is in the enrollment factor that we're talking about.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hunt. Okay, Representative Thiessen.
I'll pass.
Okay. Chair, any further...
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Mueller, I'm looking now at the page 7 and 8 of the document, the Minnesota Care. Can you help me understand, as I tried to read through this quickly while you were discussing, I'm not seeing, is there a cost shift that's happening from the Health Care Access Fund into the general fund as a result of this health match? As I look at the paragraph on page 8, I guess I'm not, and it's probably because... Either number one, I'm not too smart, or number two, hopefully because I just have read it too quickly. I'm not tracking where the money is going, because we're talking about moving people off of Minnesota Care, as I understand it, and onto medical assistance. To me, it would seem logical that there would be some kind of a cost savings in the Minnesota Care program as a result of that. I'm not seeing that, or I'm not reading that here. Can you explain that a little further?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative, there are two enrollment shifts happening in Minnesota Care. The first being a shift of GAMC enrollees into Minnesota Care, which was effective this fall. And that is shifting GAMC enrollees into Minnesota Care. And those enrollees are typically higher cost enrollees than Minnesota Care enrollees, and so they are shifting more costs into the Health Care Access Fund. There's also the shift out of Minnesota Care when Health Match is implemented, which, as we discussed, will shift enrollees from Minnesota Care to medical assistance and shift funds out of the Health Care Access Fund into the general fund.
President Cole, does that
clear as mud, Mr. Chair. No, I think, actually, Mr. Chair, Ms. Miller, thank you. I think that helps. I'm gonna pass on a follow up to this point and try to figure out the numbers, and I'll follow up if I can't do that.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Tremba?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to Health Match, is that fully ready to go?
Mr. Chair, Representative. No, Health Match is not fully ready to go. The Department of Human Services estimates that Health Match will be implemented in October of 2008.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, are they going to come and ask for more money again?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have an answer to that question.
Well, Mr. Chair, we've been looking at Health Match for a very long time, and every year they come up with another maybe $7 million, maybe $3 million every year, and then it's not implemented. So we'll have to look at what kind of money they're going to ask for this time.
Mr. Scholl, do you want to comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do know that it's not an element of the governor's budget request, and also just in terms of the complexities of the system that they're trying to work through, it is certainly a significant undertaking. It has compounded our forecasting and budgeting, though. It's certainly one element of my discussion of expenditures each year, because it is such a big factor in what happens with our health care spending.
Well, Mr. Chair,
most of the time when you have a contract, you have a contract with a dollar amount. And I've always been confused about why this contract gets to extend and actually get more money.
Okay, any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, just very quickly, is health match a federally required requirement, federally mandated?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative, no, I don't believe it's a federal mandate.
This is one of our efficiencies we put in, but that's a rhetorical comment.
Okay, seeing no other questions, and we're getting close to adjournment. Thank you very much. We will. I've got a couple of announcements, though, before you leave. One of them, our staff noticed that on page 18 of the report you were just looking at, for 09, it shouldn't be $435 million, but $135 million. That would be a typo, I assume, and they're acknowledging that. By way of announcements, the Finance Committee will meet next Monday at 8:30 a.m. Ways and Means is meeting at 10, so we're again sharing the morning. The bill that we will have up at that point will be the LCCMR recommendations. So that's a major bill, 20-some-odd million dollars in projects, so hopefully everybody will be here at 8:30. And then, in addition to that, we'll again be hearing from, or having on the schedule, the overview of the State Departments.
Mr. Chairman, with that announcement, allow a little bit of flexibility as well for next Monday's meeting, will you? Because there may be some other bills that we may need to have at a different time frame. So,
with this committee or Ways and Means, you're talking
Ways and Means.
Okay. Well, we can talk about that. We'll tentatively set it at 8:30. Are you thinking you need more time?
No, probably less.
Oh, less. So we might be able
or
to have
different.
It.
Or different. Maybe different.
Well, we'll talk, but at least at this point in time, because we had heard from your staff that you were meeting at 10.
Right.
So we'll be meeting next Monday and watch for the appropriate time. Wanted you to take note that as a part of the agenda, the recapping of the various bill referrals that have taken place earlier is included there as well for your information. Anyone else have any questions? Okay, with that, meeting adjourned.